This podcast was originally live streamed on the Non Sequitur Show on YouTube. New episodes air weekdays, Monday through Friday, at 8 p.m. Eastern at youtube.com/nonsequiturshow. Make sure you never miss a live stream by visiting www.nonsecshow.com/schedule. For the latest news, polls and updates throughout the day, follow us on Twitter at nonsecshow or facebook.com/nonsecshow. That's NONSEQ show. If you'd like to get exclusive content, bi-weekly private hangouts with Kyle and Steve, backstage access to chat with guests after shows hosted on your channel and much more, become a Patreon saint of Non Sequitur. It ensures we continue to improve our show and brings you into the process at the same time. Visit patreon.com/nonsequitur today while the limited spots are still available.
The following podcast is intended for those who believe bold ideas are righteous, unique perspectives are gospel, and strong opinions are sacred. This is Non Sequitur. Never follow. And now, here are your hosts, Kyle Curtis and Steve McRae.
What's up, everybody? Aura Elavinu here with Fully Deconverted, and today we have a slightly different show for you, so let's see if it all works out.
Commonly said that the... It's very commonly said that the root of most human unhappiness is the sense that one's life has no meaning. An individual feels that his life amounts to something when he belongs and fits in with the execution of some group enterprise. He feels he belongs in a plan. And this, too, seems to give people a sense of great satisfaction.
So many of us choose our path out of fear disguised as practicality. What we really want seems impossibly out of reach and ridiculous to expect, so we never dare to ask the universe for it. I'm the proof that you can ask the universe for it.
If I can ask the universe, then I want to tell our story. I want to tell our most cherished stories. Not just the story of humans, but of the whole universe.
Hey guys, my name is Tyler Johnson, and my friend RL is creating a community where different perceptions can be heard. He's bridging gaps between faith, fact, reason, different thinking, hearing each other's ideas. It's healthy. We need community where we're coming together. We're building unity and not disunity. And so it's a good place to be heard. It's a safe environment. So check it out. The community he's creating is called Fully Deconverted. It's a Facebook group. You definitely want to join. Get in on the discussions. The link is down here, so check out that jank and get in there. Hope to see you out there. Thanks.
What's up, everybody? Aura Elavinu. I hope you enjoyed that little intro. Something a little bit different than what we usually do. Today on the show, we have Steve McRae from Non Sequitur Show. And I'm very excited to have him on. I was on their show, and now I'm enjoying to have him over onto home turf and see what he has to say about all kinds of things. Let's see. Let's go ahead and bring him in. Steve, what's going on, my friend?
Well, hello. Wow, that was an amazing intro. I don't know how I could even come close to following something like that. That was just, wow, my mind's blown. That was great. Very well done. Extremely good production value. And it makes you think. You're like, wow, I think I understand the universe now.
Yeah. Thanks. So, Steve, 1 year ago, we had that eclipse come over the U.S. Do you remember that?
I do. Very much so. Mm-hmm.
Yeah, so on that day, I was filming that intro video when I started going independent from my Christian productions to, you know, these series of documentaries where I went on my journey and ended up in deconversion. So that's what it was. I was filming on the day of the eclipse. That was my way of announcing to the world we're going to do something else. But, and then a couple of weeks ago, I was on you guys' show. So I really appreciated that. Tell us a little bit about yourself and your show.
Well, first, when you watched the eclipse, you didn't have an awe and sense of wonder of this grand plan, or did you just go, this is really cool that scientifically we can explain this?
Yeah, that's what I'm thinking now, or was thinking at that point. I'm like, yeah, man, we can. I mean, I didn't think it was God doing the eclipse, but I just thought, man, if there's a time to start, let's do it on the day the eclipse is happening.
Awesome. It's a good transition, right? Well, anyways, I'm Steve McRae. I'm one of the co-hosts of the Non Sequitur Show. I've been the owner of the Great Debate Community for a long time, which is a G+ community that is going away, I guess. I guess G+ has decided to be no more, so we're finding another home, but it's not that critical any longer. We've kind of all gone different ways and things of that nature, but we definitely have an online presence with the YouTube community as far as the skeptics, the atheist, and even a very good rapport with many of the theists. And what we try to do is very similar to what you're doing on Fully Deconverted, building bridges and having communication between people of differing beliefs on a higher type of level rather than the base level we've seen so many times and time again, where people just bring up very prat arguments that nobody really wants to talk about any longer, because we're not at that level any longer, right? We want to have a higher caliber of discussions with higher caliber people. And I think that's how you really build bridges rather than getting away from the troll type communities that we've seen so often pop up on Facebook and G+. So I'm thrilled that you have a Facebook group of this that I was invited to, and it's very, very good. The mods, amazing.
Yeah, I'm glad to hear it. So what is the difference again then between the troll conversations and the conversations of a higher caliber? And why is that important? And I ask that question because if the troll conversations are in abundance, is there work to be done there? All right, take it away.
Yeah, I mean, there is and there isn't. I mean, unfortunately, we all have a certain amount of time that we can allocate to things, right? And when you have a theist come on and they say something along the lines of, hey, atheist, go prove God doesn't exist. That's on the caliber of an atheist saying, hey, theist, prove that God exists. I mean, they're not productive conversations. And just recently, as you may know, I had a 7-day timeout from Twitter. I had done a takedown of a gentleman named Andrew Rappaport, and Twitter, for some reason, said I was silencing his right to speech or something along those lines and gave me a week off. So I had to go somewhere else to do my Twittering, and one of which was a Facebook group that I had found, not yours, by the way, but one that is out there that I've been a member of. And the conversations in there are just very lowbrow. I mean, it's just basically people responding by memes rather than actually addressing any legitimate type of argument. And the types of arguments that are in there now, There are things that are just not worth responding to. Does an atheist believe that happens after you die? Sure, it's worth talking about, but they're not really going to get you very far in a conversation, because these people don't want to have conversations. They want to throw little hand grenades into the group and then see who responds to it, which is a troll-like thing to do, rather than say, you know what, I actually have a very legitimate argument. Why don't you try doing a analysis of this argument and see if you think it's good, see if it's valid, see if it's sound. And I'm finding that a lot of people don't possess a lot of the necessary prerequisites to actually properly analyze a good argument. And so what they do is they have this Pavlovian response and they say, you know what, you're just a troll, or you know what, oh, that doesn't make any sense, that's just word salad. And they throw out these things as if they're a actual rejoinder of some kind to the conversation or to the argument, rather than actually listen to what the person has to say. and this goes both ways. It goes for atheists and theists or anybody else that's neither of them, that if somebody has a legit argument they want to posit, take it as such. Give them a little bit of principle of charity and give them a proper response. And that's why I think that we just have so much time that we can do. And so when we have somebody that is just, we know are not looking for answers, they don't even want to like talk about the topical things, I don't really spend much time with them, honestly.
Yeah. So what happens when a group goes that way? Do we kind of abandon it like the way of the dinosaur and go start another group? Or, and I don't want to stay on this topic too long with the Facebook groups, but can there
Well, I don't think we need to start other groups, but there's a lot of different places people can go. I mean, there's a lot of groups out there. If you don't like one because it's just base level, go somewhere else. I mean, there's other things out there. There's other conversations to be had, other groups. There's shows like yours. There's shows like ours. There's other things people could be entertained by and watched rather than, you know, getting down in the muck with that kind of base level argumentation.
All right, so Steve, prior to you coming on the show, you reached out in my group and asked people what they wanted to hear you talk about. I can ask you about belief versus knowledge. I think that's a great place to start because I feel like that was my whole struggle. But out of what everybody said, what was your favorite suggestion?
Well, I got to tell you, there was a huge dichotomy between – I asked that question in your group, then I asked it in other groups. And other groups, there wasn't any really good suggestions, right?
Okay.
Every suggestion I think I got in your group, every one of them was good, if not excellent. And so that's how you address a proper post. I mean, you people are asking for advice, and I was legitimately asking for it. And I think the knowledge and the belief actually is a really good place to start because I think people have a misconception of what it takes to believe something and what it takes to have knowledge. And they throw around these terms they almost conflate them in some ways, and they also use them indiscriminately. And they say things, well, I can't believe unless I know for a fact. Well, no, that's not how it works. You can believe something. And this is one of the problems people even have with street epistemology when people have a belief, like a faith belief, right? I believe God exists, right? They might necessarily have a reason to believe in God. And you need to get to the core reasons about why they think they're justified for that belief, right? But to dismiss it outright by saying theists are never justified to believe in God, I think does a disservice to the conversation because they're not claiming it as knowledge, right? They're not saying, I know God exists. They're saying, I just hold a belief that God exists. And my only burden of proof is that I need to justify that to myself. It's called an epistemic burden of proof. So when you hear people throw around this terminology like burden of proof or epistemic burden of justification, it doesn't mean I have to prove to you anything. If I believe something to be true, I have no onus to prove it to you unless in certain circumstances, like if I say I've falsified the theory of evolution, right? At that point, you have an evidential onus, right? Because you are literally saying you're discovering something that's against science and science is already established. Science has no onus to show you anything. If I tell you evolution is something that we observe, evolutionary theory is a confirmed model, I really have no onus to demonstrate that to you beyond just pointing to a textbook and saying, hey, look, here you go. This is all the things you can read about it. This is confirmed. I don't have to confirm it to you. Does it make sense? It's a very different type of level of burden. So if I just believe something, I just have to myself demonstrate why I think I'm justified.
And is that what we're dealing with out there in the world? Then is that most of the conversations being done? Somebody has a dilemma in their self with what to them is demonstrably true. And I'm guessing this all goes off of our experiences that we use. Is that the conversation primarily happening?
Yeah, but you know, the key is finding out why they think they're justified, because that's where that's your point of attack for anything. For example, like when people use crystals, right? People say crystals have healing, right? We've all heard that before, it's like homeopathy or astrology, or any kind of pseudoscience. And you ask them, well, why do you think that these rocks have this power to do things? And they'll give you some reason. They'll give you some kind of justification, which I don't think is good, but they'll give you something. But then you ask them the pertinent questions, like, what entails this particular rock to have this power? Why does onyx good for the blood or something, or obsidian good for the blood or whatever it is? What makes it that way in the universe? And they pause and they go, well, I have no idea why it's like that. Well, because it's arbitrary. People have assigned it to be that the case. That's why there's no actual mystical, magical power that these rocks have, because there's nothing in the universe that makes it so. There's no law in the universe that says that this rock has to do this function, right? That's the point of attack when you go into these conversations to have somebody think about their beliefs, right? Because there's nothing wrong with people analyzing their beliefs. But if you just go in saying, you're a theist, you believe in God, and you're irrational, that you're shut down the conversation at that point.
So how do we engage? What is the first place to start with, let's say, you or I? And I still don't have a solid fix on where you're at theistically, atheistically, or however you would like to label it.
I'm an enigma on that.
Yeah. So I'm going to ask you directly here in a second. But let's say we're trying to figure something out. We're in the church, and somebody comes in, and because they were invited by a friend, and they say, I'm here because my friend invited me. I don't really believe in this. How does the conversation go from there with the theist demonstrating the veracity of their beliefs? Does it always have to end in a question mark?
To some degree, yes, because my particular position is I'm an agnostic. And this is something that most people in our community now understand the difference. Matter of fact, even the ACA from Texas, Matt Dillahunty, Aaron Raw, everybody that we've engaged with and I think the absolute world of, you know, Aaron is a great guy. I mean, we may not agree on everything, but these people are amazing at what they do. They're just awesome people. And I think they even realize now there's different ways you can approach things and you can define things. And even they recognize that the position they're calling atheism is Gnosticism in philosophy. Okay, it's just called something different. They call it weak atheism or what's called implicit atheism. But that's fine. That's what they want to take the label. There's nothing wrong with that. I had about a 20-minute to a half-hour conversation with genetically modified skeptic the other night, and he gave me very good justificatory reasons why he took the label atheist. I mean, he made sense, and I couldn't fault him for it. I have very good reasons why I take the label agnostic, and it is not atheism. It is not theism. It is a completely different thing. It's neither. And so when people say, well, you must be one or the other, they're already starting off on the wrong foot. That's not an actual dichotomy. That's just something that they definitionally make colloquially as a dichotomy. But in philosophy, it's not that way. But when you're talking about somebody who goes in the church, right, the theist is going to be trying to convince a person, hey, this is what you should believe, right? Almost like it's an obligation. This is what you're obligated to believe as a human, that God exists and you need to follow his plan. And here's the Bible and how you go about doing that, right? But when you ask somebody, well, what makes this obligatory? What is it that's in the scriptures that necessarily get me to God? When I deconverted, I had to think to myself, what was it that I was attaching to a label of God? Because I couldn't make that jump. My experiences, I'm fine with people having subjective experiences. We all go through subjective experiences. Everybody that's ever deconverted, most of them probably had some kind of experience they can say was a religious experience of some kind. Okay. Some of them can now fully explain it. Some can't, right? And I'm one of those people may not fully be able to explain it. But the experience doesn't get me to a deity. It just gets me to, I have some experience that I can't explain. And I think that if God existed, he would make that connection, right? And it can't be just on faith alone. When he gives us reason and he gives us the ability to think critically and he gives us the ability to do inductive arguments and deductive reasoning, without that linchpin of how to get from the feeling or the sensory thing that God gave you to him actually existing, it's like the is-ought gap in Hume's is-ought fallacy, right? It's the fact that you can't draw an is from an is for a categorical norm. And there's always a hidden premise in there. And I think that this is kind of similar. I couldn't justify any longer putting that to a deity. And then, of course, as you may know, I was Mormon. And I have the utmost respect for the Mormon church, as far as the people. I love the people, great people. I mean, I grew up with them. I will never disparage the Mormon people. And I think it's really rude when people don't know anything about the Mormon church and don't understand how kind these people really are. And they do really believe. But in 2008, they started involving themselves into political arenas where they were trying to fund Proposition 8 and try to remove the ability for homosexuals to get married. I thought that was something that a church should not do. I thought that church should not get involved in the church and state. And then I found out they were also involved in things called the Evergreen Project, which was a reparative therapy to, quote unquote, pray the gay away, which included things like electroshock therapy, right? This mortified me.
Yeah.
And it's not because I'm gay. I am completely heterosexual. People realize this, but I am one of those heterosexual males that believe you have a right to be any sexual orientation you want, anything that you were, you know, I don't believe you choose so much your sexual orientation, because I did not choose mine. Yeah. And so when I found this about the church, it maybe started down a path going, well, what else about it that I don't no longer support? And that's kind of how I led myself out of being Mormon. And I think that most people go through similar type deconversions from listening to your channel and your stories. They all seem to be very similar in some ways.
Yeah. So what's the similarity? Is it the intellectual drive out?
It's the can I actually justify this any longer?
Okay. Yeah. Yeah. I love that approach, because what I usually say when I tell somebody that I deconverted is the fact that I didn't find the core claims of Christianity evidently true. So in saying that, it's the same thing as saying the justifications fall away. The is ought. I've heard this conversation before. I don't know anything about it. Steve, can you help me out? What is that conversation? Because it sounds interesting and I've heard it a few times. What's the is ought?
In a nutshell, it's called Hume's guillotine. And what he posited was this. He said, I could have something that I know that is, which is a fact. But how do I get a value statement out of it? How do I get an ought? And you can do what's called a hypothetical norm, which is, for example, if I say, if I want to run a race, I ought to run fast, right? It just flows. That's an objective fact, right? If I want to win, I ought to run fast. Now, I can cheat, or I could want to lose. But if that's a hypothetical norm that is called, that you can derive an is from not. But the categorical norm is always. Why? If I say gold is a metal, that's a fact. But why do we value it? Why ought gold be valuable?
Yeah.
Well, there's no real reason why gold is valuable, except that it's our subjective thing, that we give it value. There's nothing what's in the universe that says gold has to be valuable, you know. And we assign it that it'd be a metal. But Hume is basically saying that there's always a hint and premise between that is and that ought, so you can't derive a value from a fact.
So then what is that argument used for then? Because I think I follow you so far. So what? Things exist.
It goes into objective morality. A lot.
Yeah, okay.
Why ought we be moral, right? Yeah. And I think one of the things that drives me crazy is that when people start talking about moral conversations and they've never read a book on the topic, they've never read a paper on the topic, they never in any way try to understand what these words mean in philosophy, like objective, subjective, absolute, relative. And even I have a very difficult time, because in the literature they are used different ways. And you hear people throw out there, oh, well, the only type of objective morality is God. Well, no. There can be objective morality without God. People saying that there can't be objective morality, well, they're flawed from the get-go, because in order to say that, they have to do what's called a reductio, or some kind of proof to show that's the case. But like Sam Harris makes a great argument for objective morality. Dr. Richard Carrier makes a great argument. But to me, it doesn't matter whether morals are objective or subjective, right? Why ought we do something isn't so much a meta-ethical position, right? It doesn't matter whether a moral fact is because we believe it to be a moral fact, or because there's some actual reason of reality, which is a objective or subjective. What I want to know is, what will you do in a given situation? What are your normative ethics, right? If I say this is your scenario, do you do the ethical thing? And what normative ethical theory do you apply to it? Virtue ethics, deontological, there's a consequentialism, utilitarianism. There's a whole bunch of ways you can show somebody this is what you should do ethically. And that's what I'm concerned about. And I don't hear a lot of those conversations. I always hear people talking about, well, morals are subjective. No, they're objective. No, they're subjective. Who cares? I want to know, what the hell are you going to do in a moral situation? Are you going to steal that candy bar because you know you can, even if nobody's watching, right? That's what I have an interest in.
So that sounds like a great kind of situational piece to work out, especially if you work for some sort of corporation or organization that has to drive home the ethics training semi-annually or annually. You know, things
been
we
there,
ought
done
not
that,
to do.
Yes.
Yeah. When I was in law enforcement, you know, we had to go through that training, I think at least once a year, and then other types of training that closely related to it, either quarterly or biannually. Now, so I get that part. And then, Steve, sometimes, you know, when you make an arrest for somebody that had possession of drugs or whatever, you know, you're in the interrogation and you're kind of thinking, okay, I get the ethics here. The ethics says, I don't want to be high on cocaine while I'm working on an airplane because that puts people's safety at risk. Okay, that's the ethics. But should cocaine be illegal always? Does this kind of breach into the is-ought philosophy or discussion? Because that's what I was thinking. Like, why does it have to be illegal always?
I don't think it should. I'm actually for advocation. I'm for legalizing drugs for the most part. We're at the point the drug war was failed from the get go. It was failed from the inception. But the is odd is more relating a fact of nature. I mean, cocaine is a drug. That's a fact. You know, okay. Why ought we legalize it is another question, right? Why should be always the categorical norm that we ought to always legalize pot? Or marijuana, or the same thing, cocaine. There's no way to actually derive that ought from that is. There's no way to say because of this, this is why we ought to do this, as there is on a hypothetical, such as, oh well, if I want to survive, I ought to eat. Yeah. Okay, that's a fair hypothetical norm, right? But what one can ask, well, why do I want to survive? Well, I mean, I have practical reasons. I have pragmatism. I have prudentialism. I have other reasons why I want to survive. But it's very difficult to get that ought from that is. And so when you're talking about objective morality, is why ought we do something objectively true all the time? Why is murder objectively wrong? Why ought we not to murder? You know, murder is bad, but bad is a subjective thing, right? Good is very difficult to even define.
Yeah, so let me pause you right there, Steve. Like, yeah, like that's it, man. That's okay. So murder is bad. Like, this is the thing we would all say, right? And yet, murder is a word which we use to reference an event or activity. Okay, and that event or activity is the cessation of one's life, usually by means of somebody else. Acting possessively in some maybe abstract way, right? Hey, I don't want you to have your life anymore, or I want your resources, no matter how our point of reference is when we're the ones committing the murder. The fact is, I don't want to explain that too much, but now a murder has occurred. So how do we go from murder occurred to murder is bad? And let me premise your response by saying, but don't we see that naturally? Don't we see murder naturally throughout the whole universe and in basically all organisms? Go for it.
Yeah, but I would take the Sam Harris approach. Sam Harris does, he tries to – there's something called the grounding problem. And the grounding problem is basically what makes something objectively true, morally speaking. There's a different type of fact out there than a normal fact, right? We already established gold is a metal. That's a fact, right? It's a fact that the Earth is not flat. That's a fact. These are objective things, and anybody, doesn't matter what you believe, can go verify. Flat earthers, you're wrong. So those are objective facts. But moral facts are a little bit different, really. How do we analyze a moral fact? How do we know what a moral fact is? Is it something we can objectively look at? And what his approach is more like the lines of harms and benefits. It's called eudaimonia, which is the flourishing of human nature, humans of itself. We do not want to cause undue harm to other people, right? So as a society, we ought not to murder because it's grounded in harms and benefits. It's harmful to society, and it doesn't benefit the society. It doesn't benefit us as a human race. That's one way to ground it. Wittgenstein, I think, grounds it in empathy or compassion, right? Because we are compassionate creatures, and morality exists only for the fact that we are actual moral agents. If we didn't exist, would there be morality?
Right. So let's say
think
no,
about
because
that.
We have the word morality. That's going to be my off-the-cuff response. We have the word morality, and this references behaviors and agreed-upon rules. All right, so that's my response.
But we also have propositions, though, that are either true and false. If I say it's always wrong to kill, I might not be referring to humans. There could be an alien race out there that has the ability to kill. That morality would affect them if they are moral agents, but not everything's a moral agent, right? I mean, animals, we don't really consider them moral agents. They kill in the wild all the time because that's how they survive. It's not an immoral act for them to kill. It is immoral for us to kill.
What's the
distinction? We are animals.
Why are we moral then? Is it our level of intelligence? And by the way, this is kind of an area that I haven't thought too much into. Okay, so and then here's my second hypothetical. Can you have a super intelligent alien species that can kill us without having any morals? And then the human race is dead.
Sure. You could have
they don't have any morale.
Yeah, I mean, well, think about it. Just because they're technologically advanced doesn't mean they have to be benevolent. I mean, do you cry when you step on an anthill? You know, you're going to think twice about it?
No.
And so there might be some super genius race out there that doesn't give a crap about the fact that we exist on this planet. And if they wanted to come take our resources, they wouldn't even give us any consideration whatsoever.
Okay,
we would call that immoral, but they may not.
Well, okay, so what about people now that are advocating against eating animals? You know, they're kind of like a lower life form compared to us in regard of intelligence and or whatever else you want to categorize them as lower in. So are we becoming cognizant because we're becoming intelligent enough to understand that they're, because we value ourselves, our conscious life, and because we can see demonstrated behaviors with lesser life forms, that we should also take care of them as well, instead of just eating them and serving them up in the buffet?
What? I don't have a major issue on ethical veganism per se, and that's exactly what you're describing, ethical veganism. Why do you not eat meat? Because I don't think it's ethical to do so. If people want to take an ethical stand, they're allowed to. I'm not an ethical veganism. I like meat. But I understand the ethical veganism position, right? But the thing is we are biologically omnivores. We are designed to eat meat. We're designed to eat plants. We eat both, and there's certain proteins you can generally only get from meat. So I think it's very unhealthy, personally, to just have a vegan-type thing. Now, I like vegan food sometimes. I'm actually, about a year or two ago, got introduced some very good vegan dishes, and I was like, man, this stuff's really good, actually. But if somebody says, well, we are stewards to animals, right? We are a higher life form when it comes to intelligence. Now, are we more evolved than any other group animal? No. All life is the same amount evolved. Every species that exists on the planet today has evolved the same amount of time, right? So we are no more evolved than an ant, but we do have higher cognitive functions, right? We have executive functions. We have cognitive decision-making abilities they don't have. And because of this, I think we've recognized that we do have things that are empathy. And the primates, they've shown empathy. Even pachyderms have shown empathy. So we recognize that we need to be stewards to these animals or the lower, you know, species that you're talking about. So I believe that they should be, you know, for food, but in an ethical type means. I'm not for trophy hunting. I'm fine for hunting for like thinning out the herds, right? I like to fish. I know that the fish probably feel some kind of pain, but they don't have like a brain nervous system that I think that we kind of have. But I think we have a responsibility to treat animals with some kind of stewardship and some type of respect. Most of us love dogs, cats. Think about it. Most people are more mortified by seeing somebody hurt a dog than another human being.
Yeah.
I'm actually one of those kind of people too. I mean, you hurt a dog and I'm probably going to try to take your life. I mean, it's just a triggering type thing, right? So I think as an evolved species, we nurture our young, right? We protect our children. And I think we translate a lot of that into protecting the defenseless things like, you know, animals like cats and dogs. And so I think we do have a responsibility for that. And I don't have any problem with ethical veganism personally, if that answers your question. Probably a long way winded way of answering, but.
No, it's all good. Because we recognize that we have biological drives to steward other life forms alongside us, and that there could be possibly an alien super race out there that might treat us a corresponding way how we would treat other life forms alongside us on Earth. Because we can recognize that, ought we to abide those biological urges, or can we deviate from that? And let's just start there. Can we deviate?
Well, that goes by your morality, right? I mean, if you think there's an objective fact out there that we ought to do something, you're an objective moral objectivist.
Let me stop you right there, Steve.
There's levels there.
Steve, let me stop you. Let me just say the person recognizes they want to abide their biological urges. But for experiment's sake, you know, for lack of a better term, right now, mm-hmm. let's say they're like, you know what? There is no real reason to get the ought from the observation, the ought from the is. Hey, mm-hmm. we have some sort of system. Don't kill. Okay. Steward animals. Okay, fine. But at this point, I would like to deviate my life a little bit and see where the dice land. After all, we've evolved this way. So essentially, these behaviors and patterns have been handed down to us. What if a whole group of people just choose to stop abiding this type of biological urge or, you know, cognitive patterns, and they just flip it? They just go against their instincts and they flip it. Ought they not to?
Well, it goes by your ethical framework. You can say this. A subjectivist and objectivist would both agree there are moral facts, and people get that confused. They hear the word subject. Oh, morals are morals are subjective. Well, yes, but if that's true, then you're saying that there are moral facts, right? But they happen to be subjective. Right, people think that if you think that it's subjective, there are no moral facts. No, a subjectivist is saying there are moral facts, but they're contingent upon what we think. So in that case, what you're talking about is that each person would have to decide for themselves individually what their idea of morality is, which is subjective to their minds. Now, I don't have a problem with that, and I don't think that it's a binary thing. I don't think morals are either objective or subjective. I think there's a quasi-realism in some way. But I tend to what's called error theory, which is completely different. But the first thing you have to look at is, are morals absolute? Right? And absolute doesn't mean objective. There's three main categories in moral objectivism. There's moral universalism, moral realism, and moral absolutism. And they mean different things. And there's not a one-size-fits-all. I would probably go to the lowest level of moral objective, which is called moral universalism, if I was deciding that morals do have some type of a reality. They're a fact, just like any other fact of the universe. I just particularly don't go to that. I think I tend to more of an anti-realist position. But that doesn't mean that it can't be the other way, right? So when you're asking me, can these people flip the switch? Well, sure, they can be subjectivist. Or they can be what's called a cultural moral relativist and say, okay, well, our society does it this way. Well, this other society does it that way. My society is no more moral than that society, right? And we do that all the time. We do compare morals, right? What we find immoral here may not be immoral somebody else. And so in an Arab country, if you show ankles, that's immoral. But over here, it's not. So morals do change culturally. Now, is there some kind of objective fact that makes showing ankles immoral? No, I don't believe that. Could there be other objective facts that exist? Yes, possible. So it's a very complicated landscape. It's not one size fits all, to say the least.
Okay. So I feel like the examples you just brought up are the easy to target examples.
Are you making this hard for me now?
I'm going to try to make it hard for you. I want to press it. Morality is something that I struggle with.
I didn't study up for this.
Good. Let's work our way through it. All right. We're going to take one more punch at it.
I just feel like just my beard. It makes everything look so much better. Yeah, exactly. Like I pretend like I know what the hell he's talking about.
Okay. I don't know what I'm talking about. But
I don't even have the time to just ask anybody. I get so much shit, dude. You don't even know.
That's what your co-host was trying to tell me, but you were making a lot of sense on that show.
I try. The people that actually go out of the way to understand me come back and go, damn, you're right, or damn, that made sense now that I think about it. They have again, they get that Pavlovian knee-jerk reaction, but once that right. kind of goes away, they're like, oh, crap, yeah, I didn't think about that. Okay, cool. All right, stump me. Go ahead. Take your best shot.
Yeah, okay, I'm going to draw a far-fetched analogy, and I'm going to try to see if we can link it in some abstract.
It's got to do with aliens, right?
Not aliens. Let's go black holes. I tried this with another guest lately, and I think whoever I tried it on, like, I lost almost instantly. we'll see if this goes somewhere.
I just had two shows on black holes, one earlier today with Dr. Philippe Goykovich, and then I had another black hole show on my channel, Steve McRae, YouTube. Go check it out. That was on black holes with Dr. John Kroon. So take a best shot. Awesome. I like black holes.
Awesome. Okay, let's run with this. All right, a black hole does not care about you. Can we agree to that?
I don't know. There might be some black holes that fall in love with me. I'm not that unlovable, but sure.
Good. That just adds to the argument. Okay, so black holes will just, let's say, annihilate you. Let's forget all the if it retains data, can data exit the universe, all that. Forget that conversation, okay? As you are, if you travel into a black hole or a star does or whatever, it just annihilates you and it consumes you. It possesses you. Okay. That's like the strongest thing we're aware of in the universe, materially speaking. So, ought black holes to be going around and doing that? Should we tell them to stop? And if they don't stop and there's no force which can confront a black hole successfully, then has our evolutionary progression as humans, other species, somehow given us a false sense of security? We're supposed to preserve ourselves. Why?
Well, first of all, there's hypothetically what's called type 3 civilization, and a type 3 civilization can actually harness the power of a black hole, right? We're not up there yet. We're like a type 1. But we're not even there yet. I think we're 0.7 on the Kardashev scale.
Yeah.
I have a hell of a time with these weird... I know what it is when I see it, right? But I hate pronouncing some of these words. But yes, we're like a 0.7 on the Kardashev scale.
Yeah.
I could do it now when I'm not thinking about it, right? But... black holes don't have agency, right? They're not agents of something of consideration, right? We don't think of inanimate objects as something that has any kind of intellect, unless you believe in a thing called a sentience, where you have like cells that actually think. It's nonsense. It really is. I don't believe anything without some kind of neural activity has a consciousness of any kind. That's just what I believe. I don't accept dualism. I'm a monolith when it comes to that, but. Black holes are not something we have any kind of moral responsibility to. Same way with when you dream. The people in your dream, they're not moral agents. You have no ethical consideration for them. You don't have any – you can't do anything immoral in a dream by the fact that it is morally inert any more than you can play a video game and do something immoral to an NPC, right? Because the NPC is not an agent of moral concern. Now, it might be – one could argue another player, you know, you cheat, you know, to another player. Is that immoral? That's an argument to be made, right? Because you're dealing with somebody who's using an avatar that represents their agency. But if you just do something to a non-playing character, then you haven't committed an immoral act. Black holes were the same thing. They're not agents of moral consideration. So we don't have to give a damn if they're what they do. And they do, like you said, destroy everything. Except for angle of momentum, charge, mass, and information, depending on if you ask Susskind or Hawking. But, well, he's dead, so you can't ask him. But, by the way, rest in peace. Big fan of Stephen Hawking. People, when he passed, it was one of the biggest losses I think we've ever had in the scientific community. But, yeah, I don't think the question really makes much sense because we don't really give a damn what black holes do. We can't change it anyways, right? And they don't go around going, hey, you know what, I want to go eat Steve or something.
Okay, cool. So we're then drawing a distinction between what we're referencing as agency and then the rest of the material universe that we don't recognize agency in. Did we just draw that distinction?
Yes, I don't believe that, like, my cup, which is, by the way, isn't kind of cool. It has no agency, right? It's not an object we care about. We can do whatever we want with it. I can throw it against the wall. I can smash it. There's nothing illegal about that. There's nothing immoral about that.
Yeah.
All right. Although I want to do this because I really like this cup.
Let's do a cut real quick. Speaking of black holes, the universe, and all of that, we're going to cut to a little video. And it'll be something that I'm sure everybody likes. And we'll come back and we'll talk about this a little bit more.
But they think that if we don't matter, 5 billion years from now, if there's going to be a time when there is a last human that dies out or the planet is destroyed and our existence is eliminated from all memory, then what's the point? They start sobbing. Why even live at all? our lives, our existence now, came at the cost of billions of prior lives. And so what was the point of their existence? Was it to be a stepping stone in generations to get to us? You know, that's pretty pathetic. I don't have this need for a predetermined purpose for my life or to be imposed on my life. If I want my life to have a purpose, I'll give it one.
That was an excerpt from the R.N. Ross series, if anybody doesn't know. So, Steve, I don't want to speak for R.N., but I want to see if I'm hearing him and I'm hearing you. It almost sounds like, you know, the only meaning is what we give it. And if we're the ones giving it, can we also dismiss it? So this whole...
I think Aaron's right on that, yeah. I do think that we give ourselves our purpose. And like example, I have a purpose to take care of my daughter, right? I have a purpose to be a good father. I have a purpose to contribute to something to society. Now, are these obligations that we have? Are they duties and from a deontological point of view? That's a different question. And people can argue that till the cows come home. But when it comes to rubber reading the road, is that what am I going to do in my life that makes my life feel like it's worth living? And of course, family, friends, community, even some kind of, people can get into hedonism or just self-gratification. We all have some kind of things that we like doing. That's fine. I think that we should give ourselves purpose that way. When a theist says, you know, if you don't have a God, you have no purpose, I think they're being very disingenuous. Because if your only purpose is because a God exists, then you really have no purpose other than what he's given you. And if he's given you free agency and free will, then you should be able to come up with your own purpose that's extraneous of his existence. And so I happen to agree with Aaron on that I think that we do give ourselves our own purpose and our own meaning contextually in how we view it, and that we stand on the shoulder of giants and the people that have been before us. And I think that's a wonderful way of looking at it personally.
And then when our memory is wiped from existence, kind of what he says.
But you know what? The universe is going to be wiped from existence one day. Yeah. The universe is not going to be around forever anyways. Everything has its time. I mean, everything that's ever been is ceasing to exist at one point. All the arts that humanity has ever had at one day will be gone. It's just a matter of scale, of time.
Yeah. So is it purely just a biological urge? All right, I want to get off this, but I want to ask one more question because these things drive me. Man, so Steve, why do we even care? Why are we talking? Why do we want ideas to spread? Why do we want to do art? Why do we want to do music? Why do we have these compulsions, towards aestheticism? Is that a word? We're recognizing, wanting to revel in the beauty that we see around us, and we have this urge and longing to prolong it and to share it with others and hopefully have that desire where others are valuing it as well. I mean, after all, you guys are producing a show, Steve, over on the Non-Secular Show, a great show at that. You guys are interviewing a lot of people. What's up with all the pride? Why do we do this? Why the drive? Is it purely biological? Is it purely an emergent property out of matter that coagulates, comes together, starts assembling itself, and then develops a nervous system? And are we the culmination of all of creation and or however you want to term it, the universe? Or is there something higher to us? And if there is something higher, and I'm throwing it on you here thick, if there is something higher, would it behave like us at all? What do you think, Steve?
It's all of the above, I think. We clearly have biological necessities, and we are driven by base level instinct. Our primate brain back there, that has been a base for humanity for a long time. We have primal urges, right? Mm-hmm. But we have had things that have emergence. Consciousness is an emergent property of the brain. The mind is an emergent property of the physical brain. And there's nothing wrong with that. I mean, there's about, I don't know, a dozen different ways of looking at the mind and the brain connection. It's one of the most complicated things I've ever tried to even try to understand, how reductionism and non-reduction case and ephrenology or whatever the hell, I can't pronounce some of these words. They're very difficult concepts to grasp, but I personally think it's a lot more simplistic. We want what's best for us, and we have empathy, we have compassion, we have love, we have the ability to want to care. Then that ability to want to care allows us to say, I you know what, I don't want this to be harmful to me. I'm not going to do it to somebody else, right? When you love somebody in your family, yeah, sure, it's a chemical, right? Okay. But does that take away from the fact that we are feeling that feeling? No, that feeling is there, right? Just because it's produced by a chemical doesn't mean that feeling is any less "quote unquote" real than anything else in that's in reality. It is something that we can sense. In that regard, it's real. It may not be something tangential, you know, tactile or anything, right? It's something we can actually touch, but it's a real feeling. That's a little bit different than something along the lines like, you know, I people like get on me about color realism, right? Because I can't tell people that colors don't exist, because they don't exist. They are, they exist only in the mind as far as what we perceive to be something that we perceive like to be the color blue. Matter of fact, pink doesn't even have a wavelength associated with it. It's a mixture of red, blue, and purple. But I think feelings, I don't want to get into like the reification fallacy where you're saying that feelings are some kind of thing that exists real in reality, just like colors don't exist real in reality. But those feelings are real to us because we experience them. And I just think that we take all these factors together, and that makes us human. That is why we are human. That's why we have we look at another person and say we should be moral to this person. We should not harm them. The most of us do. Now, there are people that have minds that think differently. That just means that I think their brains aren't functioning as properly as some other people. I think people should be rational. But when people posit there needs to be something more, there needs to be something much more metaphysical, like you had said, well, what's the next level? Well, I don't know what that would even mean to be the next level. We are just going to be continuing on. We get smarter. We get more intelligent. We might get more compassionate, or we might get might go the opposite way. We might get more savage again. It depends. But I think these things are driven by selective pressures. And in that case, if you want to relate it back to biology, then yes, I think the vast majority of it is biological. Again, another long-winded answer to a pretty kind of straightforward question, but...
I'm hanging on all that. Yeah, no, I'm hanging on all your words, man. I really appreciate it. I don't often go down this
road. Nobody else does. Okay. I love the live feed, by the way. All my friends are in the live chat. Thank you guys for joining us today. I got to tell you, I have a wonderful following. People that love watching my shows, I get the greatest compliments and greatest comments. I have no words. They are the best. I mean, they're just great people. They're fun. They're intelligent. They provide the best questions. Who could ask of anything better? You know,
that's awesome. Congratulations to you.
You have a following too.
Yeah. I suppose I do, and I also do enjoy seeing some of the regular people, like this guy I'm looking over here. What's up, Heat Shield? Heat Shield's back. I've been seeing Heat Shield for the past, I think.
Wait till your beard gets like this, though.
Steve, I tried. I'm not. I can't go that far. You know, when I first started doing documentaries, you know, I growed it out a little bit, maybe down to there, and then I'm like, you know what? And it might not come in as thick as yours. I like to keep it a little bit
closer. Well, no, maybe the color. I used to wear it short, but
yeah. So when we were on the Non Sequitur show, you did bring up colors, and I. Just because I'm personally interested in this, I want to ask you a little bit. I don't know anything about this. What do you mean there's no colors?
Color realism, and that's most of the scientific community, the cognitive scientists, think this way. when you say a color exists, you're saying that there's some kind of ontological thing in reality that exists. If I say the cup exists, I can point to the cup. I can tap on it, right? It has molecules. It has atoms. It has some kind of structure. It takes up space, right? Yeah. But a color, the color blue, for example, doesn't exist anywhere in the universe. The color we perceive to be blue is only in our brain because our brain, for some reason, is an optical illusion. It's literally perceiving something that's not an inherent intrinsic property of that object. Like your short shirt to me is a kind of like a burnt orange, right? What do you want to call it, pumpkin? I don't know.
I would say burnt orange. Okay.
But no, it looks more orange to me. But that could be my you know, we have different, you know, cameras and things of that nature. But let's say it's red. The shirt itself doesn't have that red property. It's bouncing off photons, right? It's absorbing all other colors other than red, and what we're seeing is these wavelength of photons hitting our eyes. And people can say, well, that's what we're seeing. The photons hitting our retinas, depositing energy, and the brain's translating that. But that doesn't separate what's called the phenomenon from the noumenon. And the noumenon is the thing that is what it is. It's the thing unto itself, as I believe Hume would put it, or was it Kant, one of them. But let's say when you dream and you dream in color, there's no photons involved. Your brain still perceives an image, but that image has no substance in reality. Dreams don't exist in reality. Everybody agrees with that, and they don't balk at it. But when you tell them, okay, well, dreams are in color, but you know there is no color in existence. It's the same thing. That dream doesn't exist the same way colors don't exist. What you're perceiving is only in the mind. And you can demonstrate this. It's a very good demonstration of a checkerboard that has a green cylinder on it. And if you go look at optical illusions on Wiki, it's a very good demonstration. And this checkerboard is, you know, alternate kind of grayscale. Then you have a green object sitting on it casting a shadow. And if you look at these two squares that are kind of a juxtaposition to each other, A and B, they look like they're different colors. They're definitely different luminosities. You can look at them and go, bam, these are totally different colors.
Right.
But the problem is, they're not different colors.
Yeah.
They're exactly the same luminescence. They're exactly the same hue. They're exactly the same everything. If you remove the green thing, you can see that. And if you even if you don't remove it and you draw a line between the two, you can see they're the same color. That's because color literally is an optical illusion in the brain. And if that's the case, then colors don't exist. They are your brain's interpretation of something.
Okay, so I feel like that's a great crash course right there in color. With the things that our brains perceive, is that evident anywhere else important or relevant in bringing up here? So that's interesting with colors. What else does our minds do that with?
You know what? I think we do that with everything, honestly. Okay. This might be getting a little more deep than we might want to get into, but
go for it.
I believe that we all formulate a belief web. Okay, there's something called coherentism, theory of truth, and I don't subscribe to it. I'm a foundationalist, but they're kind of related in some ways. But they're coherent. But the coherentist will say, "Do my facts correspond to other facts that I know?" And we don't ever look at what's called the territory directly, right? We never see naive realism for what it is. We never look at reality and go, "This is what reality is." What we see is filtered through sensory perception. You know, we have to look at it through light. We have to look it through our eyes. We have to have a brain process it. Everything we do is processed some way. We don't ever see base level reality. And we call that the map. And it'd be very similar if you were walking through the woods, right? And let's say you had a piece of paper in front of you that was not translucent or transparent, but you couldn't see through this piece of paper. And you had a little walking stick and you're feeling and you're like, oh, okay, something here. And you mark on your map. Okay, well, it's a little bit higher. Okay, this. Okay, it's probably a tree in this. And you're drawing the map as you are moving through reality. That is your picture of the universe. That is what they call, quote unquote, your worldview. And that's the only instance of you using that term worldview that I actually think is appropriate. I don't like using atheism as a worldview. Christianity is a worldview. I don't really like that terminology. But the map, your theory, it's called the theory of the knowledge of your reality. That is the map. That is your worldview, because you can't take that piece of paper and ever remove it and look at reality, because you always have to be filtering it through kind of some kind of senses. And that goes to that expression, don't confuse the map with the territory. And so when you ask, you know, does this apply to other things? Yes, it applies to everything, including our beliefs, because our beliefs could be wrong. We can actually draw things incorrectly. You can say, hey, you know what? This feels like this, or this is higher than this. And I can go, well, you know, it's more like this. And my map, although it might be similar to yours, it's not going to be identical. My belief map is not identical to your belief map because we have different beliefs. And beliefs, as we all know, can be wrong. But knowledge can't be wrong. There's no such thing as false knowledge. Knowledge, by definition, must be true. And that's a hard thing for a lot of people to wrap their head around. They keep on thinking to themselves, well, I don't want to believe this because I could be wrong. Well, so what? Yeah, beliefs can be wrong. Now, if you say you know something to be true, you could be wrong about having knowledge, but that knowledge cannot be wrong. It's called the principle of attribution and retraction. I'm attributing my propositional state, which in this case would be knowledge, and then, you know what? I found out I was wrong. I didn't have knowledge. And this goes back to like a meme that I saw the other day, and I know this is kind of going down a rabbit hole, but I think it's kind of segues way back to the very beginning when you're talking about the base level conversations. There was a meme that somebody put up, and it said, atheists won't disprove your God until you prove it first. Something along those lines. Very, very nonsensical statement.
Ooh, and it makes all I hear that a lot.
Absolutely nonsensical.
Yeah.
And let me explain why, because this is one of the things that make atheists look bad when they say things like this, especially to an educated theist that goes, that's just stupid. The reason being is when you prove something, it can never be disproven. Okay? Now, people can say, well, hey, Steve, you know, you're an idiot. When are they finding fault with the proof? Well, that means it was never proven to begin with. You attributed it, but then you retract that claim that it was ever proven. What if it is actually proven, it can never be disproven. So to say that a theist will have to prove their God, whatever that would mean, because you don't prove existential claims like that. Proofs exist in logic. Even science doesn't prove anything. It's a common misconception. Science never proves anything. It explains. And there's always has to be that falsification criteria. The best theories can be falsified, right? So you never prove a theory. And so when you ask a theist, well, you have to prove your God first before I can disprove it, you don't know what the hell you're talking about. Because you're literally saying if they prove their God, right, you're done. You can't disprove it at that point.
Yeah.
So it's one of those things that people throw out there as a meme, you know, or attack, but they don't realize how dumb it makes them sound by saying something like that.
I'm going to try to recap in a nutshell, capture something that you said. We go through life, sure. And our world view is that which is referencing kind of all the flagposts that we place down to recall and say, what I believe about this, and then they reference the flagpole, which identifies that environment, you know, kind of the cause and effect scenario going on, which for somebody, they might be told as a child, Aunt Sally got better because we prayed for her. So now the child planted a flag right there, grows up 15 years later without having to recall it for any other reason, that flag post now acts as part of the worldview that says when we pray, somebody gets healed. Am I on the right track so far?
Yes, very much so. Oh,
okay, but then you distinguish that from knowledge. So let me ask you, Steve, in order to have knowledge, do we reference that flag post? I think you might have said these words, against other things that we know to be true, and then find that as a false attribution? Help me out here.
Yes. Yeah.
Yeah, okay.
We made a false claim about having knowledge that we didn't have.
Got you. And then
it wasn't that the knowledge is wrong. Knowledge has to be true. We falsely thought we had knowledge when we actually didn't. A belief's different, right? We don't say we had a false. We don't say that we never had a false belief. We say that we're wrong. Our belief was false. We don't say our knowledge was false.
Got you. So how do we go from the point where God does answer my prayers, God does heal people on the street, I prayed for somebody I had pain, and they made the statement that the pain is now less or gone. How do we go from planting the flag there to arriving at a place where we can know something different?
You have to start with the theory of knowledge you wanted to actually use. And like I said, there's different theories of knowledge, there's different theories of truth. And I think that if somebody wants to really build a very strong epistemic framework, they need to dive into these things. And they need to figure out which ones that work for them. And it's not one size fit all. You could use anyone you want. But when somebody tells me that they know something, the first question I ask them is, what theory of knowledge are you using? And if they can't answer that, then I don't know if they really know what it means to know something. There's always three conditions that are necessary to be considered knowledge. It's triparte. So one, you need the proposition to be true. You need P to be true, it's called, right? So you need it to be true. You need to believe that it's true. And you need to be justified that is true. That would be called justified true belief. You hear theists all the time going, justified true belief. And an atheist goes, oh, that's nonsense. No, actually, that's not nonsense. That's actually epistemology. They're actually telling you something that is factual. Don't dismiss what somebody has to say just because you think they're a theist or an atheist. Go by what they're telling you. And justified true belief is a very legitimate theory of knowledge. I don't particularly subscribe to it. I go to reliabilism or reliably produced true belief, which is similar. But all of it means that you have to have a belief first. I cannot believe something to be true. I can't know something to be true unless I believe something to be true, because knowledge is a subset of belief. So when people say, all the time people kid around. You hear it all the time. People say, well, people don't know people don't believe Steve exists. Have you ever heard that? I get a lot. There's even memes out there. You know, I don't believe Steve exists, because I've had a lot of atheists tell me they don't hold a belief that I exist, so therefore they don't believe that I exist. And I keep telling them how irrational that sounds, because it's wrong. And they say, well, I can't know. Well, who cares if you can't know? I believe that I'm talking to you right now, right? I have that belief. I actually can say that I know that I'm talking to you, because I can justify it with my theory of knowledge and my theory of truth, which, again, like the coherentist point of view would be, well, do these facts correspond to other facts we know? Right, that's where the coherentist position would be. But truth, you know, I was watching Apologia's video today, and he had a great line from Eugenie Scott, and I've heard this before, but I didn't feel her the whole thing, like I did on his video. And she had a very brilliant way of putting this: facts are a dime a dozen. Facts are the lowest thing that we need to give a crap about. And I know a lot of atheists have a hard time thinking about that. They think, oh, it's got to be factual. No, theories are the highest thing. Then you have laws, and then you have hypotheses, and then you have facts. Because facts don't really tell you anything, right? Sure, it's a fact that this is a cup. Does it really tell you anything? But if I drop this cup, okay, it's a fact that it falls to the ground. Again, so what? But if I tell you, here's the law of gravity that models that, and here's the theory that explains the law, that's a hell of a lot more important than that fact. So on the scale of things that we should give a crap about as people that are non-believers, or even people that are believers, are facts. They're ubiquitous. Okay, sure, they're facts, but I don't think they're as important as other things. And so when you start talking about the theory of knowledge and theories of truth, those to me are more important than facts, because those are what you as a person determine what you think is the criteria to have knowledge and to have truth. I'm a foundationalist, right? And that's a very simple position. Some people, you know, like it, some people don't. But it starts off with very basic assumptions, like the universe is real. That's a very basic axiomatic assumption that's non-inferentially unjustifiable. You can't inferentially justify a properly basic belief. But you know what? I think we all start from that position. You cannot prove to me that the universe is real. You just accept that it's real. You take it as a brute fact. You take it as an axiomatic assumption. Nothing wrong with that. And I think we build a framework from those things by which we can actually start saying, from those assumptions, now we have truths. Just like we do in mathematics, right? You have Peano's axioms. You have things that you accept as axiomatically true. But now by using those axioms, you can actually do a formal proof. I can show you that the square root of 2 is irrational or something, right? So just because we start off with axioms, that things we assume that are arbitrary, doesn't mean we can't get to something that's true out of it. And I think people make a lot of mistakes when they say, well, science has assumptions. Well, so what? It's great science has assumptions. We want science to have assumptions. Now, if you can falsify one of those assumptions, you can show one of those assumptions is wrong, like the uniformity of nature. If you can show that the laws of physics today are going to differ than they are tomorrow, you're going to be famous, right?
Yeah.
So we do assume certain things, and there's nothing wrong with that. So again, just a long story short, yeah, you have to really look into what you mean by knowledge. But knowledge has to meet certain conditions. And if I say, look, I'm talking to you, I have evidence I'm talking to you, I believe that it is true, is the case, I am talking to you, am I justified to believe that? Yes, I've had conversations with other people. Unless you're a very sentient AI, that can pass the Turing test, I'm justified to believe, or excuse me, justified to know that you are not some computer. Now, but somebody says, well, you could be wrong on that. Well, so shit what? Okay, I could be wrong on that. And that means I didn't have knowledge to begin with. That's all. People are afraid of being wrong. People are afraid of not having that epistemic certainty. And I'm telling you right here and now, anybody ever listens to this, you really cannot be certain about anything if you're going to be using that as a metric. If you look at the Cartesian certainty or Descartes' version of certainty, you're never going to have it in any real capacity. Don't even try. Why? That's the theist game. The theist game says the proposition, the presuppositionist, which you know people did want me to get into, but unfortunately I don't think I have time, but they say, well, you can't know anything unless God exists. Well, why not? Yeah. Even if that was the case, even if God had all knowledge, how the hell is he going to impart it to you? You're a finite being. There's no mechanism by which he's going to tell you everything he knows, or even remotely, how would you even know it's from him? Right? So this narrative that you can only have knowledge if a deity exists is completely just – that's a game that they play. And it's wrong because to have knowledge, I can guarantee you, go look at any theory of knowledge you want. There's quite a number of them. And I've looked at all of them. Not one of them says God. Mm. Not one.
Well, okay. There you go. You have all right, Steve, you covered a lot there. I did want to ask
you. I didn't bore you. I mean, I'm afraid I'm more. I'm afraid. I've watched your other interviews, and I love them, by the way. And by the way, shout out to Atheist Edge, Jim, one of my favorite interviews. I couldn't have even seen any flaws in that interview. It was so good, so entertaining, both of you. And so I don't want to bore you by this kind of stuff. People get really bored by philosophy, which is really weird when they say, well, when I was in this group, they actually said, well, this is not a philosophy group. I'm like, it's about atheism and theism. Well, yeah, but it's not about philosophy. And I'm like, do you understand how idiotic that sounds?
Yeah.
Theism and atheism are philosophical topics. They're part of philosophy. And people seem to ignore that fact. You can't just say, I hate philosophy, then go, well, let's talk about theism or let's talk about atheism. Well, that's like saying, well, I hate science. I love biology, right? But, you know, this is not a science group. Well, biology is part of science.
Right. So, number one, Jim is awesome. I was just talking to him a little bit earlier today, by the way, over Messenger. So he's a great guy. I love that guy. Two, we are at time. What I really wanted to do is, like, interrupt you a lot and ask you a lot of questions, but I didn't want to interrupt your thought, especially at the end of the interview. All right, if anybody's watching this right now, obviously Steve McRae of the Non Sequitur Show is somebody to check out. You know, it's just what's so funny right here is speaking with your co-host and hearing the banter that you guys going back and forth. It's like, what?
We have a weird relationship. He's the very creative one, right? I mean, he does all the graphics. I do the CGI, some of the CGI, like, for example, like the dumpster fire thing with Reg Rhetoric's logo. I did all that CGI. But he does the thumbnails, and he's very, very good at that stuff. Yeah. I take care of the more scientific and the hard-hitting questions. And I'm not saying he doesn't. He has very good questions. But I look at things very analytically and very rationally, and I like to use a Socratic method and kind of get to the crux of the things, right? Which may not be always as entertaining as his style, but I think it's informative. And I think that's what the audience wants to see. They want to see that working dichotomy between both, because I find shows are either one or the other. You know, you either get this really kind of superficial crap that's just, whatever. Not to mention any of the shows out there, but there's a few. But and then the other ones are just really too... especially the theist ones. They're very, very boring, right? I mean, I don't know if you ever watched a theist show on YouTube lately, but my God, they just put me to sleep.
I tend to be entertained by all the theist shows, even if it's like radio. Like, I love listening to that stuff because I'm usually the guy in my car listening to the preacher, and I do that from time to time, like maybe once a month. Yeah, going to the gym or something, and I turn it on, it's a preacher on, and I'm going out of my mind. So for me, it's actually entertaining, even if it's like otherwise the dullest thing ever.
But don't you want to like take your head and throw it into the dashboard repeatedly when you hear certain things? And not just because, again, I am not against religious beliefs. I'm not an anti-theist by any stretch of imagination. I am not anti-Christian. I'm not anti-anything, really, per se, except for anti-young earth creationism. But when I hear people make bad arguments, whether it's become from a theist or from an atheist, I just wanted to like take my head and just smash it against the wall and say, stop doing this, you know?
Yeah. All right, well, let's make a transition from there. This is going to be a rough transition, guys, but we're a little over on time. But anyways, all right, can anybody see the shirt that I got on right here? Check that out.
Uh-huh.
RC Cola. You might not be able to make it out, but maybe you can. What's in the middle of that? Can you see that? It's really hard.
Is it an iceberg? Oh, my goodness. No, I can't.
It's a...
Is it a mountain?
Right there. That's Richard Carrier.
Yeah, I guess... Oh, that's Richard Carrier. There's no way I can see that. Okay.
Yeah, yeah.
Oh, it's his face. I get it. Now I see. Right, okay, Richard Carrier, yeah, RC. See, yeah. Now I can see. Yes. Now I can see it. Yes.
Historical flavor, mythical taste.
Paragolian, and I'm just reading that into it. Okay.
Yeah.
I like Richard. Really good guy.
Yeah. For anybody that doesn't know, we have this series coming out right now. It's going to be 10 episodes. So that's right there. So, you know, we sailed around a little bit. Here we are on a ferry right there.
I want to go have a beer with him. I know he actually does hang out and go have beers and stuff like that. Yeah, no, he seems like a pretty cool dude. He's always been really kind to me. So
he is. He is super cool dude. There's him with our t-shirt on right there. Let's see. Get one in the coffee shop right here. You know, this is someone on the ferries. Anyways, we shot in all kinds of different locations. We covered a lot of ground, and it was really great working with him and being able to produce this series. This t-shirt, by the way, is on our site. If you go to our shop, you'll find it. So we have, that's a women's shirt right there. That's a men's shirt right there. But anyways, for those of you out there, you guys can look forward to that series coming out. Before we close out, Steve, it's been a pleasure talking with you, man. Really appreciate the conversation right there. We covered kind of a lot of topics, and each of those topics are something that I would love to dive more in, maybe like a just a special focus on something and see how far deep down the rabbit hole I can go with a person like you before we both raise up our hands and like, what the hell are we talking about?
As long as we do it over beer. you know how to get in touch with me. You got a off night, just get a hold of me. We're having an off air hangout. We're hanging on Discord and ask away. I love I get inundated with messages all day long, and I gotta tell you, I love it, except for Facebook, because I don't always get my Facebook messages at all. They don't show up unless I refresh. So yeah. Don't try to reach me on Facebook, because I'm probably gonna ignore you, and not intentionally, since I don't get your messages. But I love when somebody says, hey Steve, can you come help explain this to me? And that happens daily. And to have that kind of you know, I hate to say pull or status in the community, because it's not really anything like that, but it's the fact that people want to ask you questions, I'm humbled by it. I love that. I love the fact that people don't have to believe me. They don't even have to say that I'm right, but they'll listen and take what I have to say to heart, because when I go to these other groups and I run very good arguments, they just poo-poo them away. They're like, oh, that's a stupid. Can you explain to me why it's stupid? Because I've got to tell you, it's logically correct. And what you're doing is you're shitting on logic at this point. You're literally saying logic is wrong, rather than having to realize you might have some cognitive dissonance. You might have some entrenchment effect, because what I'm saying is provable if you go by the logic. Mm. So anyways, this was fantastic. You are one of the best interviewers and just people out there for this. And I wish you the utmost success. When you get super, super big, don't forget about us little people, though, okay? Because this happened with a few other content creators over the years. You know, they come to my channel years ago, and they have like 100 subs. Now they have like 100,000, and they're like, Steve, who? I'm like, okay. No, they still talk to me. But
that's
famous one of these days, man.
Oh, man, I really appreciate the compliment on the interviewing skills. I love interviewing. I love hearing from other people because...
I can tell.
Steve, that was exactly the thing I was told I couldn't do for so long. So it's... a pleasure, and that is why Fully Deconverted exists. Steve, before we go to our closing scene here, where can everybody find you?
You can find me on my actual channel, Steve McRae, spelled this way. And you can also find me on the Non Sequitur show. We do that Monday through Friday, and we do occasionally on Saturday and Sundays as well. So check me out there. I'm also on Facebook. You can find me on Twitter, which is the home of my dumpster fires. If you ever want to have some fun, go follow me on Twitter, Steve McRae_. And I got to tell you, I have more fun on Twitter than I do anywhere else, because, oh, man, do people get triggered on Twitter. And I'm not going to front. I enjoy triggering people that are just not that hip on this stuff. And I'm sorry. I'm a bad man. I'm sorry, not sorry. But they're so base level. I know people enjoy watching me do it. And so I can't help it. It's fun. Because they do. People get triggered on for whatever reason on Twitter so bad. It's like, I'm blocking you. Okay.
Yeah, I enjoy the occasional cross path of people on theist groups that I post in on Facebook. So I do enjoy that, actually, even though it comes off as very contentious. I do enjoy it.
Oh, yeah. Very contentious. And there's, you're so arrogant. It's like, no, this is how I portray myself in these groups. Because I want to see if they actually address the arguments rather than attack me personally, right? So yeah. They just say, oh, well, Steve, you're so arrogant about your argument. Well, who cares? I could be anybody. Just attack what's being presented. And I think they miss out on an opportunity when they attack the person rather than attack the argument. And So I do get a little over the top on Twitter and Facebook for a reason. Because I want to see if they're going to ignore the fact that I'm just going to be this boisterous asshole. Or if they're going to say, well, yeah, you know what? He might be an asshole, but he's right. Because you know Arne very well. And you might know Arne's story of when he was telling people at one time that humans weren't monkeys, and he came across this, you know, phylogenetics expert that explained to him that no, humans are monkeys, and they fought for ages because the guy was an asshole. But Arne realized eventually he was right, and Arne, you know, is brilliant on that. He's basically, you know what, it doesn't matter whether you're an asshole or you're a nice guy. If you're right, you're right.
You're right. Yeah. I love that. All right, ladies and gentlemen, that has been Steve McRae. Steve, tell everybody bye.
And thank you for your service, by the way.
Thank you, sir. All right, Steve, hang on for just a second and see everybody.
This podcast was originally live streamed on the Non Sequitur Show on YouTube. New episodes air weekdays, Monday through Friday, at 8 p.m. Eastern at youtube.com/nonsequiturshow. Make sure you never miss a live stream by visiting www.nonsecshow.com/schedule. For the latest news, polls, and updates throughout the day, follow us on Twitter at nonsecshow or facebook.com/nonsecshow. That's NONSEQ show. If you'd like to get exclusive content, bi-weekly private hangouts with Kyle and Steve, backstage access to chat with guests after shows hosted on your channel, and much more, become a Patreon saint of Non Sequitur. It ensures we continue to improve our show and brings you into the process at the same time. Visit patreon.com/nonsequitur today while the limited spots are still available.
The following podcast is intended for those who believe bold ideas are righteous, unique perspectives are gospel, and strong opinions are sacred. This is Non Sequitur. Never follow. And now, here are your hosts, Kyle Curtis and Steve McRae.